For centuries, streets were places for people. For people and horses and carts and bicycles, all making their own way at their own pace. They were open space. Mothers sent their children to play in the street. But a century ago, against angry opposition, Los Angeles handed its streets over to the automobile, and the world followed. But now American cities are fighting back. The latest, as of last year, is New York, where people are free once more to jaywalk. Other cities are set to follow, abolishing relic laws, as the abolishers call them. Relic laws that only ensnare people in the criminal legal system. Peter Norton has been watching American pedestrians reclaiming the street. Peter is Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and the author of several books on the age of the automobile, how the car reshaped American cities, and how pedestrians became, for a century at least, pariahs. Peter, welcome to Late Night Live.
It's a pleasure to be with you, David.
Peter, what were streets like when the first automobiles, when the first cars nosed down them?
It was a place for people. It was a public space. And Australia and the U.S. have a lot in common in this respect because of our inheritance of the British common law tradition. And so even the judges, even the officialdom, stood for the right of the pedestrian, including the child, to roam into the street. In fact, judges in that tradition, in Britain, in America, in Canada, in Australia and New Zealand, all stood by and defended this right of even children to the unaccompanied use of the streets. And what this meant was that the responsibility for safety lay with those who stood to endanger others with their vehicles. And when motor vehicles were new, that meant the motorist was the responsible party.
But this was holding the industry back by the 1920s.
That's exactly right. So if you are thinking about buying an automobile in, say, 1910 or 1920, as they're becoming much more common, one reason why you might refuse to buy one, even if you could afford it, was that if you lived in a city or a town, you were constantly having to pause to let pedestrians roam across the street, and they had the legal priority to do so. And if you weren't yielding out of courtesy, then you were probably yielding out of self-interest, because the legal liability lay on your shoulders as the motorist, no matter where you injured a pedestrian. The pedestrian could be in the middle of the street and not looking, but the responsibility still lay on you, the motorist. And that was an obstacle to sales. And because it was an obstacle to sales, people who wanted to sell automobiles worked to change that.
And how did they go about that task?
Well, they had many different ways. Some of them worked better than others. One of the ways that didn't work so well was to just use your influence as a business group, like an automobile club or an automobile dealers association, and get your influence expressed in the form of a law restricting walking in streets. And there was such a law in Kansas City, Missouri, in 1912, but it was not a big success because local people resented it. After all, from their point of view, streets were for everybody, and the law was on their side historically in that respect. But this new local law was at odds with that. So it really earned the contempt of a lot of local people. And so that was the kind of strategy that did not succeed. What makes Los Angeles the real pioneer was that even though it came later than Kansas City and didn't have a real ordinance of this kind until 100 years ago, 1925, it pursued a much more effective strategy. The business associations that wanted this to work were very clear that to make it work, they needed to change minds as well as change laws, and to deploy psychological and social pressure techniques like making pedestrians feel ashamed or embarrassed or attract ridicule to them. And in fact, the word jaywalker comes from a term of derision, Midwestern U.S. slang from the Kansas, Missouri area. In that slang, a Jay was a foolish throwback from another era, somebody not in step with the 20th century, a rural hick or rube. And so even the word jaywalker itself reflects the fact that success would require psychology as well as law.
And there were Jay drivers as well, I understand.
That's exactly right. In fact, Jay Driver and Jay Walker began at about the same time, obviously in the part of America where Jay actually meant anything, that this term of slang was not well known in most of the U.S. It was well known in the middle of the country, where probably by association with the Jay Bird, which says a lot but doesn't know anything, Jay was a foolish person. And it was a useful prefix. You could put it in front of anything you wanted. You could have a J-town, and that would be a town without a theater or a library. And you could have a J-walker, and that would be somebody who didn't know how to walk in the 20th century city. But it could also be J-driver, which would mean somebody who didn't know how to drive even a wagon in the city. And so they drove in such a way that they obstructed other people. And J-driver and J-walker began at about the same time, about 1905, but Jay Walker had a big, powerful collection of business groups out to promote the word, which is why that was the word that survived while Jay Driver withered and died on the vine.
Now, not a rube, not somebody who didn't know his way around, was Miller McClintock. Tell us about this guy who really, for the most of the world, defined the notion of the street.
That's right. So Miller McClintock was a young man in 1924. He, at that time, he was 30 years old. He was a Chaucer scholar in college, hoping to find something more lucrative. So he was pursuing a PhD, and he was writing a dissertation about traffic, which was motor traffic, was a brand new subject for cities, and he thought that was his opportunity. And he was on a study tour for his dissertation, taking the train to U.S. cities to study their traffic conditions. When he got to Los Angeles, he met somebody who saw a real opportunity in Miller McClintock to get the change that he wanted. That man that he met was named Paul Hoffman, who was Los Angeles's most successful automobile dealer. Now, automobile dealers were, as we've already discussed, very threatened by the laws that favored pedestrians, because not only did drivers have to slow down for pedestrians, but drivers were also legally liable for injuring pedestrians anywhere in the street. So Hoffman, who was very influential in Los Angeles, he had the attention of everybody on city council, was facing a dilemma. He couldn't write a new traffic law for Los Angeles himself because he was an automobile dealer. That would just look odd on its face. But he thought, I can get this young man, Miller McClintock, to write it for me. And he has academic credentials. He's working on a dissertation on traffic. We'll make him the first expert on traffic. And I'll influence him to make sure he writes this traffic law the way I want it. And that's exactly what Miller McClintock did. It was extremely lucrative, as it happened, for Miller McClintock, but also very beneficial to Hoffman, too, because he got that Los Angeles traffic ordinance of 1925, which went into effect exactly 100 years ago, not because the people of Los Angeles voted for it or demanded it. In fact, there, as you said in your introduction, there was a lot of resentment about it. It happened because Paul Hoffman was a very shrewd businessman, and Miller McClintock was a very good drafter of just the kind of traffic ordinance that Hoffman wanted.
And so was created in law a new category of person, the jaywalker. Now, Peter, I have to confess to being a lifelong jaywalker, and I know that I'm going to die probably doing what I've loved so much through my life, which is jaywalking. And jaywalking remains a human passion, don't you think? It has not been eliminated by laws all around the world.
That's exactly right. In fact, if you look at where people go, people who have the means to holiday where they want, if they go to a city or a town, They always choose the one where people are roaming freely. I mean, if you go to a beautiful old Renaissance city in Italy or Paris or maybe a city in the Caribbean, as many Americans like to go to, or in Mexico, this is where Americans holiday. People who holiday in Europe pick beautiful old cities with squares that are popular with people strolling and walking. And I think it tells us something about what makes a city work. What makes a city work, we can't just measure by the number of automobiles per hour on a road. That could just be a highway interchange, not a real city at all. If we measure a city's vitality properly, then I think we would find that the more walking there is, the more you have a thriving city.
Absolutely true in the case of Australia. You can go to respectable cities in this country. I'm not going to name them, of course, because we have loyal listeners in those cities. But there can be not a car in sight, and yet they will not walk across the lights. It's extraordinary.
Yes, I think you're pointing to something that I see here as well, which is after a few generations of normalizing this sort of car dominant situation, many people, even when they're walking, behave as though the automobile is the superior entity. They will yield to it even where they have the right of way. Almost every day in my town in Virginia, from the window of my office, I can watch as young American college students wait at marked crosswalks where they have the right of way until there's no car in sight, and then they will finally cross. So I think we're seeing the success of the effort to plant in our minds the notion that the automobile's right to the street is superior. I'm reminded of something Germans said when the country reunified. They said that long after reunification, they still had a wall in their minds. And I think as we are reexamining what we want our cities in Australia and America to be, we still often find that the biggest impediments are in our minds, because we all grew up learning in school and from authority figures and in safety lessons and films that the automobile is the superior right, has the superior right to the street, and we should defer to it everywhere. And I think it's time to question that.
On Late Night Live, I'm talking to Peter Norton about the history, the invention of the jaywalker. Now, look, the Los Angeles development spread around the world. Why? Because it worked?
Well, in a word, yes. But the particulars are that in the U.S., the automobile interest groups, mainly the automobile clubs and the automobile dealers, got together and said, look, we want the Los Angeles example to be the example for the whole country. They lobbied successfully to have a model municipal traffic ordinance drafted, and by that I mean a traffic ordinance that any city could just plug in without having to write it themselves. And they got the U.S. government to put its seal of approval on it through the United States Department of Commerce, and it proliferated such that today in 2025, in most of America, the local ordinance that you are working under as you walk about the streets is in some way descended from that Los Angeles ordinance. And because the U.S. was early to motorize, early to adopt the automobile, as other countries followed and motorized as well, they looked to the U.S. example to see how they could promote their automobile-centered agendas as well. That includes in Australia and especially in the English-speaking world. This was the U.S. was the model or the pattern. So the National Roads and Motorists Association in Australia served a role closely analogous to the American Automobile Association in the U.S. of promoting the interests of drivers, often at the expense of pedestrians.
Did these new rules actually save lives?
No. That's how they were always sold. But I've read the internal conversations among the people who were promoting these rules and claiming that they would save lives. But what they say among themselves is this will finally let us sell more cars and let us have higher speed limits and make life as a motorist less of a nuisance and more of a pleasure. So I think the motive was clear. It's not me reading the motive into it. They were pretty clear about their motive themselves, and that was to sell more cars and to make driving easier. But to make that claim more palatable, they said their motives were safety. Now, it can be counterintuitive. You tell somebody that you actually make walking more hazardous by restricting jaywalking, and they'll question you, and it's a very reasonable question, but I think it works like this. The more everyday and normal and routine and common you make walking, and the easier and more convenient you make walking, the more people walk. And the more people walk, the safer walking is. It's the safest to walk in a city like Amsterdam or Florence or many other cities around the world where walking is very common, because then the drivers are all on the alert all the time for walkers. And this means that walking is safer, and walking is the most dangerous wherever it's uncommon. So in the U.S., what we call the Sun Belt cities, and that means the cities, particularly in the southern and southwestern states, are notoriously dangerous because everything was designed for drivers, and therefore walking is rare. And because walking is rare, the drivers drive fast and don't pay attention, with the result that walking is also very dangerous in those places.
But the rules against jaywalking in the United States have, over time, become used against blacks.
Yes. There's a long history in the U.S. going back to Reconstruction, the era after the Civil War, and even into the slavery era, where law enforcement was, to some degree, associated with racial policing. So, for example, fugitive slaves were a law enforcement problem when slaves escaped from their owners. In the Reconstruction era in the South after the Civil War, often it was police departments who made sure that despite emancipation and the end of slavery, black people knew their place, so to speak. In other words, knew that they were the subordinate race in that racial caste system. So policing in the U.S. has a history of this, and it spread all over the country. It was not limited to the South. It was also very significant in U.S. cities because so many Southern black Americans moved to the cities in the 20th century. And this meant that local white populations that were already there saw police as a way to protect them from this perceived threat. So because of these legacies of history in American policing has often been used in the U.S. As a way to control or constrain black people. And jaywalking laws were a convenient way to do that, because while most people jaywalk whenever it's convenient to do so, police could selectively enforce it against black people as a way of exerting control. And there have been studies that show that, in fact, black Americans were much more likely to be stopped for jaywalking than a jaywalking white American doing the same kind of infraction. There have even been experiments where white volunteers and black volunteers jaywalked, and the black ones were far more likely to be stopped. That's one reason why there has been some retreat from the jaywalking laws that were ubiquitous until very recently.
How big is that retreat going to be, do you think?
So far, it's very small. I mean, it's not insignificant. The whole state of California passed a law called the Freedom to Walk Act 2 years ago that did not exactly abolish jaywalking, but made it much less restrictive. The whole state of Virginia, where I live, did the same thing. New York City has as well. But it's not really a tide of change. It seems to have run its course. I think there was some momentum following the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis in 2020. But, you know, as every listener to your program, I'm sure, will know, there's been a backlash now in this country, and that now there's a pause on this reexamination of racial injustice in law.
But surely Donald Trump stands above all things for the freedom to cross a street whenever you want. I mean, isn't that MAGA?
You know, I would think exactly that, but we don't expect logic from MAGA, or at least I don't. I don't want to presume anything, but I don't expect logic in MAGA, and the MAGA logic inherited an older logic in the U.S. that connects driving with freedom, and any restriction on driving is therefore a restriction of freedom. And for that reason, you know, efforts to relax laws against jaywalking get misrepresented as laws that restrict motorists' freedom. So it's very easy for MAGA to object to anything that relaxes the jaywalking laws.
Peter, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live to bring us up to date on this.
It's been a pleasure.
I've been speaking to Peter Norton, Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia, who is the author of several books and papers on automobiles and America and how they have shaped the life of not just that country, but the world, including Street Rivals, Jaywalking, and the Invention of the Motor Age Street.